I seek refuge from the devil, Satan. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most merciful and beneficent. If I may introduce myself, Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters, friends, comrades. Welcome to this special seminar. It's an emergency type of event, given what's happening here and globally, namely the meltdown, which some of the establishment are fearing to use. They think it's a hiccup. We'll soon find out. So basically, I wish to welcome in particular all those who've made the effort from other parts of the country. You know, this is not just a London event, just for those who are here for the first time. By the way, I forgot to mention, I am, for those who don't know, a lot of obviously the people here do know me. My name is Moeen Yassin. I'm the founder director of Global Vision 2000, an independent international Islamic think tank. I don't want to dwell too much on that. As long as you know, we've got website, we've been on television, but we can come back to that. So a big welcome to those who've travelled, in particular Daud from India. Just shows you the amount of commitment and sacrifice we need to make things happen, otherwise they're not going to happen. And also people have come from Scotland and other cities, from England and Scotland and elsewhere. And indeed, thank you everyone for making the effort to, you know, spare your weekend. Now, a quick word on Global Vision. As I mentioned, it's an independent Islamic think tank. We do believe in Islam as the solution, not as the problem. It's in the news again this morning, terror plots. You know, people want to blow us up. But isn't the reality that the global financial system is terrorizing everybody? Yet the diversion day in, day out. Global Vision is committed to an Islamic renaissance. It's not going to happen overnight. Some of the people in this room represent efforts, movements, so I'm pleased we're in good company here. Having said that, Global Vision is not a political party. It's not, you know, linked to any sect. But we're focusing on what we call the paradigm shift. As I mentioned to some people, that's a bit like in the medieval age when people were talking about, was the earth at the center of the world or the sun? We are in a similar reality in the modern world where the democratic or neoliberal capitalism, whatever you want to call it, New World Order, is at the center of the world. A lot of people who are in the Muslim camp and non-Muslim camp believe it is fundamentally flawed and are seeking its, to be polite, a transition to a new world order. So that's the meeting ground, really, those who want to, you know, have a paradigm shift. Today's event, what's happened here, for those who might not know really what's going on here, you know, this has not come out of the blue. We have tried to bring selected people, organizations, academic thinkers, from Muslim and non-Muslim backgrounds who will share their lifetime work, and I mean lifetime. There's still people, you know, going to come in. And I'm very pleased to introduce them when they come. So basically, we hope to benefit from their experience and expertise. And the movements that I've targeted today was the monetary reform movement. In this country, there is a rich tradition of those who believe, Muslim and non-Muslim, Christian and Islamic, who believe the fundamental issue is money. By money, I mean the creation of money, control and use. And a lot of effort has gone into that. Money makes the world go round, you know, but not deep enough analysis and collaboration, cross-fertilization has happened between, for instance, those who have been studying the banking and the financial system and those who want to stop war, for instance. I don't believe enough cross-fertilization has happened, for instance, with the anti-war peace movements and those who have been working on fundamental reappraisal reform of the banking and financial system. And obviously we've got the people who represent the Islamic movements here. One of the world's leading global Islamic political parties is represented here today. So there's actually three movements here today. The monetary reform movement, the anti-war pro-peace, and the Islamic movement of representatives, of substance. Also, we've got the Islamic Party of Britain, the founder and director David Pidcock. So even an Islamic party from this country, not just a global one, like Hizbul Tahrir, who have been maligned by the establishment. So that's some of the threads in this meeting. Today's conference, ladies and gentlemen, also comes at a time in this great city in which I believe fear is rampant, and as I mentioned, not fear of terror, which has deliberately been created by the establishment. Oh, they're going to blow him, her, us, you know, day in, day out. It's actually the fear of what's going to happen to people's jobs, institutions, because of the credit crisis, the crunch, bailouts, the lot. You know, that is fear. There's fear in the city. Or the City of London, should I say, in particular, but it's going to spread everywhere. So there's fear. People are talking about the quadriative cycle every 60 odd years. Bankruptcies, credit crunch, inflation, boom, bust. That's the talk in the bars and elsewhere. The other point I want to make is that too many people out there who should know better are sitting on the fence. Too many people, despite the demos and all the rest of it. You know, the classical tool of control of the masses, bread and circuses, the Colosseum in Rome. Too many people out there who should be, you know, re-educating themselves politically and otherwise. You know, their energies are being diverted. And also, I would argue, too many religious people, you know, massive world faiths out there, are looking at superficial issues, you know, of dogma, ritual. You know, have you prayed, brother, five times a day? I'm not saying that's not relevant, but, you know, come on. Why we pray is to discipline ourselves, is to work collectively for what? Change, social, political change. So, from both camps, you know, whether it's the spiritual people, faith communities, they're not addressing the real issues. Likewise, in the non-Muslim camp, hedonism, materialism, bread and circus is the order of the day. It's not good enough. It's got to change. And that's why I deliberately stalled this meeting for Islam Channel to be able to broadcast this event. And I'm very pleased that we have got the support of one satellite channel, at least, who you know, put their money where their mouth is, and who plan to make a documentary of this, which I'm very pleased to say, called Market Meldon. And what can I say about the BBC? We invited them. End of the day, the result was, you know, we're all taxpayers. Oh, brother, we've got the Olympics to cover. The official line of the BBC. What an insult to every speaker here who has made an effort to share their knowledge to be the solution as opposed to the part of the problem. Finally, one of the key issues in this debate on paradigm shift is to demystify economics and finance. I've said that on Press TV. In front of economists. For too long have economists and bankers been seen as the be-all and know-all, yeah, in which the common man, yeah, has to bow down and listen to. the economy, you know, is at their mercy, our livelihoods, the lot. That has to blow away. It's like the priesthood in the medieval age. They used Latin. The people didn't know Latin, yet your salvation was dependent on these people. The science of economics has got to be demystified. And that's why I'm very pleased that this program, hopefully, will go beyond this room to over 1 million people, inshallah, if not more. Finally, somebody said to me, a very well-connected, you know, people were pitched, to use a business term, some people very connected to the establishment, both Gulf and British, said, Moin, I've looked at your agenda. Wow, it's strong. Well, it was deliberately meant to be strong. As I said, you cannot remain on the fence. And he also then said, it's not just strong. Are you trying to be an enemy of the state or a friend? Brothers, sisters, friends and comrades. It just shows you the climate out there. The climate out there. People have got ideological positions, yeah? Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? And let me tell you, this event isn't about positioning yourself as an enemy of the state. It's about truth and justice. It boils down to that. It's about those who want to promote and go on a path of truth and justice and oppose falsehood and injustice. That's what it's about. It's not about transforming ourselves into enemies of the state or friends of it either. It's about truth and justice. Thank you. Now, if I may, I'm very pleased that at this event we've been able to attract the attention of some political activists and politicians. So I will be delighted to invite Murad Qureshi on my right-hand side, far right, to represent the Greater London Assembly as a member. Murad, please.
Thank you, Moin. I'm usually not used to being on the far right. I'm usually on the far left in the London Assembly. And unfortunately, if the projections are right, we may be seeing BNP presence on the London Assembly. So please take my apologies that I will have to leave straight after I've said my piece, but I intend to return. I just got a whole host of people across the road waiting on my doorstep now to pick up leaflets to distribute.
But I was very pleased.
I was very
we
pleased.
Can't hear at the back.
Is it not on? Okay. I was very pleased to take this opportunity to come here and speak because, actually, as a candidate at the forthcoming election on the 1st of May, it's been apparent to me what the issues are. Now, locally, we've got issues about the expansion of Heathrow. That's a bit of a joke, given the screw up they made with Terminal 5 last weekend. Post office closures, whether the government is prepared to continue paying the subsidies or not. And more London-wide, it's transport, further investment there in policing as well, as well as hopefully future investment in housing. But the reality is, quite honestly, it's the economy, stupid. If anyone knows anything about London at the moment, I think there's more anxiety on that front than people appreciate. That's not surprising, because 1 in 4 Londoners work in financial services, and we're actually probably more interlinked with the American economy than other parts of the British economy. We certainly have, complement, thanks, New York. So anything that happens in New York will invariably happen here. So I would suggest if New York has flu, we'll have pneumonia. And this may be what we're touching on here, because I think some of the headlines this week and last few weeks in the business press, the Economist, the FT, suggest actually the financial sector itself is very worried. And I think this is probably going to be deeper than a recession. Let's see what's around. I think actually we've been talking around around it for some while. Now, technically, with the economics I was taught, if you have two quarters of negative growth rates, you've got a recession. I suspect it's going to be deeper than that. I'd like to think actually London is in a better position to come out of it, and I'll explain that a little later. But I've always known when I was doing my economics at A-level, undergraduate, and then when I did a master's, that economics is not science. It's about human relations at the end, and particularly financial relationships between lenders and borrowers. And there have been a few illusions in this whole sector for a long, long time. For example, if we had all decided, even during good times, to pull out our savings from banks, there would be a financial crisis anyway. What we've got now is a system which is built upon that illusion several times more so than they even know themselves. So that's why they've stopped lending amongst themselves. They're much more cautious about the collateral that's been offered between themselves, let alone what they're offering to the customer out there. So that's what I think makes me feel this is going to be much more deeper. And I, for the record, certainly want to go down as a politician that's not arguing for tinkering with interest rates, because I think it's lost its power. Present circumstances, that's the only instrument I think the Bank of England have got, but actually it's probably going to be pretty ineffectual because we've got increasing energy costs and food prices globally, so it will have an impact here, if not already. But actually, we need to regulate the city much, much more. And there's a particular sector, which I haven't got my head around at all, but I know is very prominent in London, the hedge funds. And unfortunately, a lot of pension funds have gone into that, which makes it potentially very risky for our lifestyles after we retire. And I mean, it'll be interesting to see how bits of London like Mayfair get affected by what I think invariably will happen, hedge funds probably losing their shirt. That said, I do think what we're looking at, there will be a disproportionate effect in London in terms of the British economy. For some reason, we're just over-dependent on the sector. But there are some things in the real economy which we've got set in place which may help to see us through all this. And it's old-fashioned Keynesian demand management. So it's something I learned at A-level economics, and I think it will serve us well in the immediate future, where we've got big capital budgets on projects like the Olympics, 10 billion, Crossrail, another 20 billion, and then other works like sewerage infrastructure under the Thames, a tidal wave, which could be easily another 4 or 6 million. And those are the kind of things we've traditionally done to get ourselves out of difficult financial times. And again, it's another classic case of the real part of the economy bailing out the financial sector. And the most recent example, and something which the government doesn't like admitting to, but I think the nationalisation of the Northern Rock, they actually found it very difficult to use the N-word, but it intriguingly, people like the Lib Dems found it much easier to use the word than, unfortunately, my party. That actually, I think the tectonic plates have shifted considerably, more so than we like to appreciate. And I think we have to be... We have to acknowledge this and at least put things in place which actually can deal with it. And regulation of the city, further regulation, certainly is a must on which we should build on. Now, Martin, you touched on the Islamic implications of this very vaguely, and I would want to deal with this quite directly, because one of the things which may bail out the financial sector here in London, New York, and what have you, are the big sovereign funds. Most of them sit in the Middle East from the oil surpluses and what have you. I do think, actually, we need to think more carefully. Well, I think people like the Dubai Investment Authority need to think more carefully about what their role is in all this. I think it's been quite ludicrous, the hypocrisy of the city actually being very keen to promote Sharia-compliant funds investments, whilst on the social front, it's been the whole idea that some people may want to, in the Orthodox community, live under Sharia-compliant legal family law as being outside of what's acceptable British practice. But the irony is that the city are promoting this, I would suggest, to attract those big sovereign funds from the Middle East, sitting on the capital receipts of the oil oil price increases that they've recently been fortunate to have, I would like to see them actually invest that more strategically in the developing world. I can almost certainly tell you this, they'll get better rates of returns in places like Pakistan, Bangladesh and what have you, rather than here. And actually at the moment, I would suggest they'll have less security than ever. And I think that's where I think global vision has to be fought for and given. And who knows, we can give it from this conference and venues like this, where at least we can start putting those ideas around, which hopefully can have some acceptance in the right quarters, so that people can start thinking imaginatively about how we move on beyond this crisis in capitalism. I'd like to leave it there, because I'm sure there's plenty of ground still left to cover. And if you don't mind, Roy, I'll quietly move out, but I will come and join you later on in the afternoon.
Right. Thank you. Before you go, Murad, I'll take you up on your offer, definitely. What is it all about? You mentioned your last point, other than city regulation, you mentioned sovereign funds, yeah. Basically, you know, Islamic liquidity being rediverted. Since you're in the GLA, an event like this should ideally be there. So I hope we can, and I'm sure others will take you up on that.
Yeah.
Well, there's just one qualification to that. I've got to get re-elected on the 1st of May. I can't assume too much, because it's actually going to be a very difficult election, hence why I'm leaving early. I will be around later on the afternoon, so I will pop in.
Okay, thank you very much.
To the other speakers on platform.
Okay, thank you. See you later. If I can now, but hopeless with this mic here. If I can now pass the beacon of light or baton, should I say, to Lindsay German. I'm delighted she's made the effort to come here. She, just to introduce in what capacity she is speaking, Leftist Respect Coalition mayoral candidate, you know, in the forthcoming GLA elections. It's a great pleasure to have you here, Lindsay, because I also have attended the anti-war, you know, demos like most people here probably. So, over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation. Okay, I'm also completely hopeless with microphones, but I hope people can hear me. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here speaking about this subject, because it seems to me that we are at a turning point in the world, and it's a very, very important turning point that all the things that we've been told about the neoliberal phase of capitalism, all the things that we've been told that indeed from a well-known British Chancellor, who told us that he had seen the end of boom and bust, and that there would be, he'd got rid of the unevenness in the economic cycle, that there would never any more be recession, depression, or any of the things that now are on the lips of everybody. Of course, that man's name is Gordon Brown, and he's now the Prime Minister presiding over a Labour government, which Murad referred to earlier about the need for Keynesian solutions and spending money on things like new tube lines and the Olympics and so on, but which this government is very much opposed to, the idea of public money going to boost the economy, apart from when it benefits a small number of people. And if you look at the Northern Rock fiasco, it's worth just examining. This was a building society where essentially people would invest money in the building society. It would be lent out to people who wanted to borrow in order to buy houses or to take out loans for some other reason. The demutualisation of the building societies led to them behaving not just like banks, but behaving in the most reckless way, like banks who didn't wait for investment but just kept borrowing on the market and therefore were subject to all the vagaries of the market. When Northern Rock found that it was exposed in this way because it had been involved in... I mean, if you ever tried to get a mortgage, Northern Rock was always one of the most favourable companies because it always offered some of the most favourable rates, so millions of people took up the offer to get a cheap mortgage. Once they found that they couldn't sustain these mortgages and they weren't being lent to by other banks, there was a huge crisis. The government refused for months to step in and intervene and refused, as Murad said, to use the word nationalisation. They eventually had to, but it's very revealing. They've lent, well, nobody quite knows, but something like 50 billion, of which Northern Rock say they will pay back half in by 2010. But it was revealed only this week that 50 million of that money was spent on consultants, on private consultants, in order to avoid nationalisation. In other words, taxpayers' money in this country was used for purely ideological reasons by a Labour government to try and avoid what seems to me would be a sensible solution. And I think one of the things that should be done with Northern Rock now, rather than it being as is going to happen, that thousands of workers there will lose their jobs and all these kind of things, I think it would make sense for it to be an investment bank backed up by the government, which lent at low rates of interest. So that's one thing which I think is important. But I think more fundamentally, we're facing not just a crisis about one bank or even one city. We are now facing, I think, what is going to become a world economic crisis, or is becoming a world economic crisis. The headlines of the Financial Times today, I think, are quite revealing. There are two of them. One is a third of all housing deals fall through, you know, because people who want to buy houses simply cannot find the money, the loans to do so. And a third is a huge number when you're thinking about what that means for a crash in the economy. The other headline, lower down, although of more importance to more people in the world, fears of social unrest as rice prices surge by 10% to hit a fresh high. Now, what you're therefore facing is a big rise in commodity prices. Already, they're worried that the poorest people in the world and the hungriest people in the world will not be able to be fed. They're worried that in a rich country like Britain, and Britain is the fourth richest country in the world, that many, many people are going to suffer very severely. And I think one of the big questions for those who are standing, and the reason I'm standing on the left list and want to put an alternative to Labour, is I think we have to ask very fundamental questions. Why is it, in one of the richest cities in the world, is inequality growing? That the rich are getting richer? And I mean, I must say, when Murad said maybe it will affect Mayfair with the banking crisis, but I have to say that I hope it does affect Mayfair with the banking crisis, because I think there's something obscene about the people who can pay more for a meal in a restaurant than many people earn in a whole month. And it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that we shouldn't want to happen in any decent society, that any civilised society should be talking about closing and eventually eradicating the gap between rich and poor, should be talking about emergency programmes which provide a house for everybody. I mean, to see homeless people on the streets of London is something that shouldn't happen in the 21st century. Charles Dickens wrote about it, but I could take you to places in London now where things don't look too different from what Dickens wrote about then, and that is a shocking thing for a country which is so rich. And we have to look at these much bigger questions of inequality, of why a tiny minority own the wealth. And this is a global question, it's not just a British question. And therefore, even when people talk about the sovereign funds, I'm not happy with the notion that small numbers of very rich people in the oil-producing states determine what goes to the people in Africa or indeed people in Britain. I don't think they should be controlling the wealth in those countries. I believe that the people who produce the wealth should essentially be the people who benefit from it and who decide where it is spent. And that just brings me to a couple of concluding remarks. John will speak more about this, I guess. But one is about the question of war, that we are now engaged in two very serious wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. This year alone, the British Parliament has estimated that the cost of those wars will be £3 billion. And this is at a time when our pensioners are the poorest in Europe, when we can't afford new schools without putting money from millionaires into them. And all these things, I think we have to look not just what is wrong with those wars, but why. the resources of the world are always available for wars and these kind of things, and not for the things that people need. The final point I wanted to make is this, and again it was alluded to in the previous speech, that what they do when they have an economic crisis, they try to blame the people who are already suffering. So they'll try to cut people's jobs and cut people's wages, which is what they're doing to the teachers and the civil servants in Britain now. They try to make people accept higher prices, so more of their wages go on basic things that they need to live. And of course they try to scapegoat people. There was a report this week from the House of Lords, who no doubt would know about these things, where they said that the house prices in Britain are going to be raised by immigration. Now, most immigrants I know in Britain couldn't afford a studio flat in London, let alone to raise the house prices in London by 10%. The house prices in London have been raised by easy credit and by the speculative buy-to-let thing, which is now accounts for half of the new houses and flats built in London. So they're trying to scapegoat immigrants, and the immigrants built this city, and they continue to build this city, and therefore, in my view, should have the same rights as anybody else who lives in this city. And they're also, as was referred to in the opening remarks, they also try to ramp up the fear of terror, of Islam, because Islam is now equated with terror, with all these kind of things. I'd just like to end with one little story, which I'm probably the only person in the room who remembers, although some of the older people might do as well. But back in the 1970s, just round the corner from here, literally round the corner, there was a siege where two IRA men were escaping from the police and got into somebody's flat and held these people hostage for a few days. And the police surrounded it. It was a big siege just near Baker Street Station. It was a little council flat these people lived in. And in the end, this couple who were besieged ended up as relatively sympathetic to the IRA people, probably because they had two or three days where they told them exactly what their grievances were. So, but the interesting addendum to this story, which people don't know about in most cases, a couple of years later, the woman in the flat who was besieged was made redundant. And she said it was very bad in the siege in all sorts of ways. I was very frightened, but it was nowhere near as bad as losing my job and losing my livelihood and all this kind of thing. And they want to distract from the big things that are going on in our lives by trying to tell people horror stories about terrorism and all this kind of thing. And we have to, as well as discussing the economics, we have to resist these questions of racism and Islamophobia politically as well, because they are a very, very important part of the onslaught which is coming from the bankers and the city and the people who run this country.
Thank you, Lindsay, for those thought-provoking insights and political recommendations. Again, Global Vision and our partners here, I'm sure, will be very pleased to collaborate with you, whether you are elected as mayor or in other capacities. Thank you very much. Now, if I may now introduce our final opening guest, John Rees. Probably most of you will know him. He is representing Stop the War Coalition as convener, I understand. One of the great, I don't want to use the word protest movements, but you know, great movements in this country. John, great pleasure to have you here. Over to you.
Moeen talked about the paradigm shift, and I think that we should note that there is at least a minor paradigm shift already taking place, because the turmoil in the financial markets and the onset of a recession in America, which I believe will become a global recession, has already, it seems to me, destroyed to a large extent the existing economic paradigm, which has dominated the establishment discourse about economics since the late 1970s. In the late 1970s, I suppose, signalled but not caused by the election of Ronald Reagan in the United States and Margaret Thatcher, 1979 and 1980, respectively, in this country, marked the banishment of the post-Second World War welfare state Keynesian consensus. From increasingly from that moment on, neoliberal economics, the economics of deregulation and privatisation, have been the dominant model up until, I would say, the current period. But what is happening now is destroying that economic model, is destroying the hegemony of that particular school of economics almost on a daily basis. My evidence for this is I only have a subscription to one magazine, and that magazine is The Economist. I love The Economist for two reasons. One, it has a good deal of interesting information that you don't get anywhere else. And two, because it's the kind of internal bulletin of the capitalist class, it just says things just right out there that you will never read in the popular press or hear said on the BBC. They don't have to worry that too many ordinary people will hear it, because that's not their audience, so they can afford to speak a little bit more directly and a little bit more honestly. So although I almost never agree with the judgments of The Economist, I love to read it. Because it's only really in The Economist this week that you'll know that Joseph Ackermann, who is the head of the Deutsche Bank, and who is described, this is an example of the language that you get in The Economist that you don't get elsewhere, who is described by The Economist as an uber-capitalist, made this point recently. He said, "I no longer believe in the market's self-healing powers." Well, there's a fairly important international capitalist who has just decided to dump the Reagan-Thatcher neoliberal economic model, because the whole basis of this model was that the markets were not only self-regulating and self-healing, but the best possible, indeed the only realistic way of distributing goods and services, and that anything which got in the way of the free market, any state regulation or unwarranted interference by minor irritations like trade unions, should be banished and eradicated as quick as possible. And in the wake of this remark, The Economist adds its own gloss on the history of capitalism and financial markets. And it puts it this way. It says, "The history of financial markets is not a stable one. They have imploded every decade or so, whether because the French and Spanish kings reneged on their debt in the 16th century or because speculators inflated railway stock in the 19th century." Now, that's a pretty damning statement about the history of modern capitalism, to say that every decade, every 10 years, for five centuries, there has been a financial crisis is, it seems to me, an epitaph for the system. It is an admission that this system has systemically failed over a time trial which is basically rather too long for most ordinary people. And the reason it fails, let's just be clear, because it isn't difficult to grasp. The Economist says that the finance is a brain for matching labour to capital. But the problem is, it's not. It's not a brain at all, because a brain, in this sentence, gives you the impression that there is some kind of all-seeing force which is looking at what capital and what labour are available and matching them together for some greater purpose. Presumably, in the mind of The Economist, the profits of a minority. Lots of us might like to think, and the ideologists of capitalism tell us, for the good of the majority. But for whatever reason, it implies that there is some regulatory mechanism, something that has an understanding of what the different elements in the system is and marries them up. But of course, if you didn't learn it from Karl Marx, you must have learned it from Margaret Thatcher. Capitalism is about competition. It is about different units, unrelated to one another, searching the market to ally capital and labour for their profit. But the definition of a competitive system is that there is nobody overseeing it, nobody regulating it, no overarching administrative force which is bringing together capital and labour in harmonious ways. The competition destroys the possibility of there being regulation and a meaningful matching up of economic resources. Those who say competition inevitably say chaos in the system, because whether it's financial institutions like banks chasing a subprime mortgage customers, or whether it's car manufacturers chasing a market, or supermarket chains chasing customers, they have no way, precisely because they compete against each other, of not ending up in a situation where they either underestimate the market and underproduce, or overestimate the market and overproduce. But what actually happens is that the cycle inevitably moves between boom and bust in a competitive system, which is why Gordon Brown never had any chance of delivering on the promise to abolish boom and bust. He was wedded to a system, wedded to an ideology, which at its heart produces boom and bust, and inevitably works in a way which impoverishes, marginalises, and rips out the standard of living of those who work in it. Just let me give you an example, because it's a big social example in the history of this country, perhaps one of the most important in post-war history. And I want to talk a little bit about the miners' strike of the mid-1980s, because it was a very, very clear offensive on the part of the Thatcher government, justified in the name of free market economics. In the mid-1980s, essentially what the coal board, backed by the Thatcher government, said to the miners and others was, listen, we're under the threat of competition from the Polish, Australian, American coal industry, and if we're going to make a profit, you people, the miners, are going to have to work harder and longer, with less of you, in order to stay afloat in a competitive market. That was the argument of the coal board, it was the argument of the government. The miners didn't accept it, many of the rest of us didn't accept it. We fought, we lost, I don't want to go into the reasons, but because we lost, everything that the Tory government demanded happened in the British mines. There were closures, there were sackings, there were worse conditions, there was a worse safety record. People did, fewer of them, work harder and longer for less. But the trouble was, in other places, the bosses of other coal industries were saying exactly the same to their miners. The Polish coal owners, the American coal owners, the Australian coal owners were saying, hey, look, the British, they're working, the Brits, they're working harder and longer for less, so you people, you've got to work longer and harder for less, otherwise we'll lose our markets to the British. Come 1990, the Tory government, in the form of Michael Heseltine, comes again, one more time, to the British coal industry, the British miners, say, hey, look, I know we told you all this in the 1980s, but there's been another round of competitive increase, and so you people have got to work even harder, for even longer, for even less, and broke the entire coal industry in the process. Now, a lot of this was politically motivated, but the core of it was this understanding that if there's a competitive economic system, in the end, it's the people who do the work in it who have to pay with their wages, their conditions, their health, their working hours, their wages, in order to make the system work. And that is now going to happen on an absolutely massive scale, including people's provision of housing, including their jobs, including their wages, and that's what's happening with the series of confrontations which the government is now having with the PCS, the teachers who will be on strike in a couple of weeks' time over this, and in the housing market as well. But it's worse than that. And this is where I want to make the connection between what happens in the economic system and the war. Because a competitive economic system doesn't just work, you know, if you're taught, you know, I was lucky actually, I was taught economics in David Ricardo's old house. David Ricardo is one of the founders of the dismal science, 19th century British economist. I was taught economics in his old house. And one of the things they taught me about it was that the economic rules of the game stay within the economic sphere. But anybody who studies the real world knows that isn't true. It isn't true that huge multinational corporations simply compete with other huge multinational corporations by trying to lower their unit costs, by trying to discover new markets, by trying to, you know, out-produce or more competitively produce. They don't. They don't stick within the economic sphere. They seek to alter the political environment, the military environment, the competition between the state systems. They seek to alter that environment so that they disable their competitors in non-economic ways. Anybody who looks at the way in which the contracts in post-war Iraq, in occupied Iraq, were handed out to the corporations know that direct political interference, The use of military means to extend economic competition is not something which is an unfortunate kind of aberration in the system. It is the normal operation of the system. It is absolutely normal in this system that competitive economic environments lead to competitive military and political environments, and that military force is used to alter the balance of competition. So not only is a competitive system a system which systematically seeks to lower the living standards of the majority of people who work for it, it is also a system in which military conflict, conflict between states, is generated as a result of economic competition and for economic ends. So we have a system which systematically works in a chaotic way to the disadvantage of the majority of people in it, and systematically works in a brutal, in a brutal and militaristic way as well. Now, there have been attempts to provide an alternative to this system. The change in welfare state model was one. The state-dominated systems, either state-dominated systems with of the political right, such as fascism, or state-dominated political systems, supposedly of the left, like the Stalinist systems. There is one model, one paradigm shift, which has not been tried. It is this. It is the democratic control, the democratic regulation of the economic system by the majority of people who do the work in it, by the majority of people on whose behalf it is supposed to operate. That is the paradigm shift that we need. The paradigm shift that we need is one that says it is not good enough to have a system which gives people political rights, but denies them democratic control over some of the most important things in their lives. There is no point electing your MP if the dictator in your firm determines that without your voice, you will lose your job, lose your house, lose your income. Some of the most important things about people's lives, how much they'll be paid, how long they work, what they can afford to buy on the supermarket shelves with their wages, are determined by economic dictators over whom there is no democratic control at all. And it seems to me one essential definition of any radical, certainly any left-wing or socialist project, is this. That it begins to put the argument that we should have at least the same democratic control over the economic system that we are supposed to have over the political system. Now, there was a time when it was seen as impossible to do that. In a land dominated by despots and kings in the late Middle Ages, it was seen as impossible that any ordinary population could democratically elect its government. That paradigm shift was made. This paradigm shift needs to be made.
Thank you very much, John, for that passionate and visionary contribution. Although it went over time, I'm sure it was appreciated. We need passion, not just... exactly. Our expert wordsmith. Well, John, I know you have to go now. These were just the opening remarks. You can imagine some of our great scholars are dying to get on board. So, before I say a round of applause, I will take you up also on collaboration, because one of Global Vision's business models as a network flat organization, if you want to call it, is building communities of collaboration. As you probably know, we respect quite a challenge, and a lot of people are there too. Unless we collaborate, we're going to get nowhere with a paradigm shift. There is no Superman out there unless Jesus alayhi salam comes, you know, second coming or the Mahdi. But in the meantime, we've got to do our bit, and I hope we can join hands, forces, and resources. A round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, I'll let you go, and we look forward to meeting again. Could Tariq, thank you, could Tariq Diwani please come to the stage? And also, because we're running obviously behind time, could also Canon Peter Challen come to the stage? And indeed, Dawood.
Thanks a lot.
So if all three speakers who are in the next session come to the stage, so we, you know, find a way, one, two, three. So Tariq, Yeah, please. And then also, Donald, if you can come up on the stage, and Peter, please, can join me. Yeah, I just hope the technology works here. Yes. The next speaker is Tariq Diwani. After Tariq will be Peter Shannon, and then Donald Pidcock. Yes, hello. Yes. What we will do, because of people's delays, we do want to be professional. It's not a one-way traffic here. Instead of the 25 minutes allocated, we'll compress it to, I know it's going to be difficult, but 15 if you can. Or 20 in Doug's case. Trey, you know, have, I wouldn't say fuzzy duddies, but we've had a certain image of Islam. Tariq, you know, obviously is a new generation and is also steeped in the knowledge of the City of London and also Islamic finance. He's the director of IslamicFinance.com, and the title of his contribution is Why Are We All in Debt? Before he speaks, please, housekeeping notes, please everyone put off your mobiles. It's a distraction and it's not fair. Also, this has been recorded, should have said that earlier on. Tariq, over to you, please. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. Good morning. Thank you, Wayne. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. 15 minutes for me to give you an outline of the problems that we're facing at a systemic level, the history of the problem, and the development to where we are today in money, banking, and usury. I often say in talks that I give in London that if you were standing on the street outside 500 years ago and a man came to you and wanted to lend you money for a commercial gain, then he'd be committing a criminal offence. And today, if you look at that situation, this scourge on society has actually traversed the entire social spectrum, so that now he sits in something that looks like a palace, called the Bank of England, from where he can make a single announcement and change the value of your wealth. You see, so they call it central bank independence, but this man has more power than the Prime Minister. You know, at least the Prime Minister has to go to Parliament to change the value of your wealth. So this change that took place over 400 to 500 years, didn't happen by accident. It was part of a transition from a society which was ruled by a religious edict, by a religious law, to one that we have today where it's ruled by economists and people who invent theories really to justify their own power base. And I think largely in that transition we've had various techniques that have been used. One of them is semantics. Semantics have been used a great deal. We used to call it usury. Usury was any charge for a loan, whether it was 0.1% or 100%, it was usury. And then they invented this thing called inter essa. And inter essa was you could make a usury-free loan, but if the guy was late repaying at the end of the loan period, then you could charge him a penalty. And the penalty applied between the date on which he should have repaid and the date on which he did repay, and that was the period in between. The period that in between is the period that inter essa. And so we had this kind of semantic change. And the establishment today uses semantics all over the place. Banks don't practice usury anymore. They sell you a mortgage. You see. Gambling has become gaming, playing a fruit machine. Adultery has become swinging. Homosexual has become gay. This is all part of the way of making something which God prohibited into something which is permissible. And so this transition in Christianity, I'm afraid, is happening now in Islam. Mm-hmm. And the name that's given to this weapon is Islamic banking. And we have to understand, really, that this system of Islamic banking is a Trojan horse, is the best way of describing it. Because Islam is the last ideology, religion, worldview, that has substantial force in the belief of the believers and in its theory, uncorrupted still, that says that usury is prohibited and defines usury correctly. And against this ideology, whether it's very small in economic power, whether it's very small in military power, a system that is making $1 trillion a year out of usury does not want this ideology to blossom. So however small it is, it must be opposed, destroyed, co-opted, neutralized, but in some way deactivated. And this is why we see so many Western banks going into Islamic banking today, because they can work from within Islamic banking to change it. So the result is that we have now a system globally which is based upon usury and based upon something in addition, which is fraud. And this fraud is the fraud of money creation. Money creation is the thing that gives usury its extra power, because in the days of old, a banker couldn't create gold coins out of nothing. You couldn't create gold. You had to go and mine it. You couldn't create silver. You had to go and mine it from the ground. It required effort. When the monetary system was changed so that paper, token money, had the force of law to support it as money, that you were forced to accept the banker's paper as money, then this was a nirvana for the bankers, because they could create as much money as they wanted by printing it and lend it to you at usury. So today, banking, this global financial system, relies on these two things: the fraud of creating money out of nothing and the practice of lending it at usury. And the result is that we have a world in debt. If you are a banker creating money from nothing, then you will create as much as you can, because the more money you create, the more interest you can earn. So it's in your interest to create money and lend it at interest, you see. So no matter what the theories have said, and if you will, World Bank Economics, IMF journals, you've written for 50 years, have been saying transitional developing countries, they can borrow money, invest it, repay later on. But it never happens, because the debt just grows from year to year. And I've been giving this presentation for 15 years. I haven't really had to change it, I just update the figures. See, the evidence never contradicts the theory. The debt just grows. And the debt service, I mean, we're giving aid to these countries, which is fantastic, I'm in favour of that, but the interest payment is bigger than the aid we give. So we're giving with one hand, taking with the other. And it's very substantially bigger. You see, so for Angola, it gets $260 million of aid, it pays more than $1 billion back in 1 year. And within the rich economies, the system is active as well, so that if you look in the United Kingdom, the United States, the debt owed to banks is also growing. And this is over a period of 10 years of very rapid economic growth. I mean, just imagine, huge economic growth, and we still can't repay our debt. So what does this mean? You know, if we have a recession, then what happens to our debt? Our debt has, you know, almost tripled, more than tripled in some cases, despite huge economic growth. And you look at this as a fraction of GDP, the debt-to-GDP ratio, is actually growing, despite our economic growth. So the figures are all pointing to the fact that we are in a debt trap. We can't grow our way out of debt. That doesn't work. And the wealth inequality results. If you lend money at interest, you, as a banker, will look to lend money to people who have good collateral. You don't want to take project risk. This is a typical feature of banking that every businessman knows. A bank does not want to take project risk. He wants to lend you 100, so long as he gets 110 back. And what does this mean? It means that for a bank, if you're going to lend money, you want to see some collateral in your borrower. You want to see someone who's rich, then you'll lend to him. A bank is an institution that lends money to you if you can show that you don't really need it. That is the collateral-based system of lending. And therefore, if you're a poor man with a good business idea, a bank won't finance you. He doesn't want to share your profit and loss. He wants to charge interest. He wants to fix his gain in advance, which means that the poor people stay poor. They don't get the capital from the banking system. It's the rich people who get the capital. So wealth circulates among the rich of the community and not among the poor, and wealth inequality increases. And we're seeing that on a fundamental scale across the world now, whether it's in rich or poor countries or between rich and poor, wealth inequality is increasing dramatically. Just to have a look at this money creation issue, here is our first goldsmith operating in the 17th century in England. In London, he has his bank. He takes a deposit of 100 gold coins. He issues 100 receipts. The receipts promise to repay the gold coins on demand. You can come with your receipts to me, the bank, I'll give you your 100 gold coins, because your receipt says I promised to pay £100 on demand. Yeah? When people start to use this receipt as money, when you start to buy your things from this brother here, and he goes and uses that receipt to buy his supplies from this brother here, when that receipt starts to circulate, it's become money. It is now money. It's not a receipt for money, it's money. And the bank knows this, and it sees this, and it says, hang on a sec, we can change our business model. We're not just going to keep people's gold coins safe, we're going to lend money. And when the people come to borrow money, the bank just creates £400 of paper out of nothing and lends it to you at interest. That is banking. That is the banks do not take money from one lot of people and lend it on to another at a higher interest rate. That's not what they do. They create the money from nothing. That's how they do it then. This is how they do it now. The 1844 Bank Charter Act, Robert Peel said, we can't have this money creation business anymore. It's destroying the economy. It's creating boom and bust. We're all getting in debt. Let's have a system where the banks have to keep a reserve, full reserve against their note issue. The bank said, fine, no problem. Why did they say that? They said that because they'd invented a new system, which is this check and account system. And the check and account system works like this. You have one bank in your economy. Again, I'm simplifying. The banker puts 10 coins, 10 pounds of equity into his balance sheet. He's got 10 pounds of coins as his assets, so his balance sheet balances. Now two customers come, person A, person B. They open an account. Person A wants to buy something from person B, 100 pounds for a watch maybe. Person A pays with a check. Person B takes the check, goes to his bank, deposits the check, and the banker debits person A with 100 pounds, credit person B. That's the balancing entry. And you can see that £100 of money has appeared out of nothing. It's just there in B's account.
Come buy a coin.
B and it is. Notice if person B goes to get his money out of the bank, his coins, the bank can't pay. It doesn't have the money. That is Northern Rock. That is why we have Northern Rock. Because banks create money out of nothing. But have you heard it? Have you heard a single journalist say that in the media? And look, person A is in debt. That's great for the bank, because he earns the interest. And if person A tries to repay his debt, maybe person A sells something to person B, and this transaction reverses if person A buys a table from person B and pays the check to the bank, then the money just disappears. Because the transactions are reversed. So repaying debt destroys money, and we have a recession. So we can't repay our debt. We have to keep our debt, and because debt pays interest, the debt grows. There you are. That's why we are all in debt. Look at some figures, real figures. That £100 of money in the bank's person B's account at the bank, what does it look like today with real figures? Here is HSBC. It has £3,618 million of cash, the cash that's now created by the government, in its vault, awaiting people who come to demand for repayment on their site deposit accounts. In site deposit accounts, HSBC is promising to repay on demand £168,000 million of cash, but it doesn't have that cash. So if enough people go, and only a few people need to go to HSBC to ask for their money, HSBC will fold like Northern Rock. And this is why the journalists can't tell you the truth. Because if they tell you this, there'll be queues outside Northern Rock and HSBC and Lloyds Bank and all the rest of them. And in a night, the system will collapse. They can't be honest with you about it. It's not because some of them do want to be honest, but they can't be, and they're being pressured not to be. And I know that. And the red line here is how the bank money creation has grown over the years. You can see the little blue line at the bottom is the amount of money the government creates. The red line is the amount of money the banks are creating. And effectively, we're paying interest on that huge amount of money, over £1.5 trillion. Society is paying interest on that amount of money every year. It's a tax that's going to the banking system. Some of the binary economists, others, Peter, for example, will propose that instead of the government borrowing money at interest from the banks, well, the banks are going to create that money from nothing, so why doesn't the government create the money from nothing and borrow it interest-free? It can do it. It's done it before. This is one of the problems that you have when banks pump money into the system. They want to lend to earn interest. Who do they lend it to? Here they lend it to home buyers. Home buyers borrow the money, buy houses, house prices increase. It's natural. You're pumping out the balloon. If you're sitting there in 1963, you think, I want to buy a house, it's £3,000, you try to save for that house. By 1973, when you've saved that amount of money, house price has gone up to 10,000. So you try to save 10,000. By the time you've done that, house price is 26,000. You can never save for a house. What do you do then? You go to the bank to borrow money. But the money that the bank lends you is new money. And when you buy your house, house prices go up. So the solution that you use to buy your house is the problem for the next guy. You see, we're in a system, we're trapped by it. They're very clever, really. 3 minutes. I always put this one in because, you know, there's this big hand with a label that says conspiracy theorist, and they're always trying to, you know, whack it on your forehead. But this is the founder of the Bank of England, and he said it. He very neatly summed it up. The bank had benefit of interest on all monies that it creates out of nothing. You know, the founder of the Bank of England said it. The American founding fathers, they understood this system, and they didn't want it in America, so they made it a condition in the Constitution that only gold and silver could be used as money. They didn't want European money-creating usury in America. It's very clear. And one of the reasons is that gold holds its value better than paper money. That's one of the economic reasons. It's purely empirical. I'm not making a religious judgment. You look over any period of time that's more than 5 years, there is no developing country currency which has held its value better than gold. And most of the time that's true for developed country currencies as well. You want a good store of value? Gold is better than paper. That's just the empirical data telling us that. And that's why the Americans wanted it. And when they tried to have a central bank, Andrew Jackson said, "Look, I don't want you guys here. I'm not going to renew your charter." And he said that, you know, these guys have tried to unseat me politically by creating a recession, by contracting the money supply. And so it's quite right what the previous speaker was saying. You know, the corporate banking system is using politics to further its aims. Last thing.
Well, you've got one.
You want me to show that, Ken? For you, I'll do it. Right. Interest-free money issued by the British government in 1914 at Bradbury. That is the government saying, we're not going to borrow money from the banks. We're going to create it ourselves and lend it to ourselves interest-free. What a fantastic saving for society. You could save tens of billions for this country alone. It's a political winner. Just if you tell the people, it's all you've got to do. Because they'll accept this, they'll understand it. If you explain it to them, you only have to explain it, you see. A Bradbury. Corporate leverage. This is where we've got to. Why did the corporate sector accept this system? They accepted it because they could make profit out of it. You had a businessman. He had a business that earned 30% return on assets or 20% return on assets in this example. The bank lends him money at 5%. The businessman makes 20% profit. 5% goes back to the bank in interest charges. 15% is kept by the businessman. Okay, the businessman invests some of his own money, some of the bank's money, keeps the juice for himself and pays 5% interest to the bank. Now, if you have £100, yeah, and you've borrowed the £100 from the bank, you make £20 profit, pay £5 back to the bank, you keep 15 profit for yourself. So the idea of corporate leverage is to borrow as much as you can. Don't borrow £100, borrow 100 million, and you keep 15 million for yourself. Borrow a billion, keep 150 million for yourself. Borrow big. And when you have large amounts of money being borrowed, large amounts of money being borrowed by single businessmen, by single corporations, it enables them to swallow up the business opportunities that small business would otherwise have. And the result is this, is that you can go down the high street and you can see all of these shops selling clothes, you know, and they're competing, you know, in the same area very often, and you see people going from one shop to the other comparing prices, and of course there is no competition because they're all owned by Philip Green. Yeah. So this is market competition in the 21st century. It's just a lie. We're being sold a sham. There is no competition. This is what it looks like physically. That's Lakeside. There are all of those shops on those two levels in this one shop, this one precinct of the shop. All of those shops there are Philip's shops. Yeah, but what is that? That's not a market. And this is my village, the one I always show. I have to show it because it's been 15 years. My village, old village, beautiful, grew naturally like a tree. Everybody built his own house, yeah. Built it the way they wanted from their own materials to suit their own needs. And if you go down the bottom of that street, see, I think that's beautiful. If you go down the bottom of that street and turn right, you'll come to this.
Philip Green.
Philip's Green. Yeah. Corporate leverage. One company, one design of house, same sets of materials. No American tourists go to see that. And they never will. And we cannot build the kind of world we love in this country anymore. We can't build it. We're building that because we can't afford to. We are not wealthier. This is when we were wealthy, St. Pancras Station. Beautiful brickwork. We can't afford it anymore. We build this at Pancras Station now. Bits of plastic and glass clipped together. These skilled labourers who don't care for their jobs because they're employees. They're not artisans. And the prophet, peace be upon him, I'll skip to this one. This is the summary. Even though usury is much, you can earn lots of usury, but in the end, it leads to utter poverty. And that poverty now is in the third world, but tomorrow it will be here, unless we do something.